You are listening to The History of Religions and Their Gods, hosted by yours truly, the Skeptical Ghost Heathen. You're going to want a Scooby snack and a Dr. Pepper for this one, guys. Hello, heathens, and welcome back to the show. Today is May 3rd, 2023. And unfortunately, by the time you guys hear this episode, Cinco de Mayo will have simply come and gone. So please, have a Corona on me while you're listening to this episode and put a little twist of lime in there. But if you really know the heathen, you're actually going to pour yourself a little Basil Hayden. That's right, a little bit of bourbon. One ice cube, maybe. Let it dilute a little bit. But you are listening to The History of Religions and Their Gods, and we are in Chapter 6 of Mark's Homeric Epic and the Gospel of Odysseus. And I hope that you're really enjoying this series of looking at all the comparisons, the imitations, the emulations that this author for Mark used to create a story for Jesus by emulating, copying, and imitating the characters taken from the Odyssey and the Iliad. Both works from Homer. Anyway, we're going to get started on this thing, and I hope you're really enjoying it, and a shout out to Dennis McDonald for doing the work for us here, and I'm merely recanting it to you guys for your own listening pleasure, but really exciting. And another thing that I want you to think about, and I'll call it out as we're going through these similarities, because this is just making the attachments to the Homeric epics, but there are also the connections to Josephus's Wars of the Jews, or at a minimum, the events of the war. And we'll talk about those as I think about them throughout the podcast or this particular episode. But this author for Mark, the guy was no dummy. This guy was quite genius to appeal to two major epic novels. One being the Jewish Old Testament, Jewish scripture, and then the other one to the Greek Homeric epics. So you're catering to the Jewish audience that would only understand the parallels from Jewish scripture and those that actually read the Greek novels. So super interesting about how this guy is able to morph these two great epics into one story of Jesus, but with two very different backstories. So without further ado, let's rock and roll, baby. Jesus' story, his most determined and dangerous opponents were the Jewish authorities. Despite their various designations, such as the infamous Pharisees, or the untrusting scribes, the Sadducee cult leaders and the Herodians, of course, the elders and chief priests, for example. In fact, the religious authorities form a united front to oppose Jesus, and therefore constitute literary critically, a single or perhaps a collective character. The author for the Markan Gospel depicts them as the usurpers of rights that rightly belonged to Jesus. And consequently, the conflict between Jesus and the Jewish authorities, the elite members of Jewish society, and Mark's story is an extended clash over the subject of authority. Now, Mark obviously didn't invent these conflicts between his Jesus and the Jewish leaders. They were traditional by the time of his purported life, and quite possibly might reflect some of the controversies if there was a historical Jesus. But Mark's distinctive depiction of them may be neither historical nor traditional. Now, once again, when we read Mark's words intertextually, alongside with Homer's Odyssey, they play a role similar to that of Penelope's suitors, who seized the authority of Odysseus' estate, and were even willing to kill in order to protect their privileged status. Early on in the Odyssey, Homer warned his readers that the suitors planned to kill Telemachus on his return from Pylos, and Odysseus too if he should return. All throughout the poem, Homer constantly reminds his readers about the suitors' murderous intentions. Plotting in their hearts, Telemachus is plunged to death. And they plot to kill his beloved son on his way back home. So the suitors in this story, they did not have their hearts set on sharing Penelope's bed, but instead dividing her wealth and property among themselves. If they would win the wealth, they would also need to remove the heir. Now, just like in Mark's story, he never lets his readers, or hearers for that matter, forget the plots of the Jewish authorities against Jesus, who is God's beloved son. Even in Galilee, Jesus' opponents have ties to Jerusalem, which prepares the reader to expect the worst from when Jesus returns back to the holy city. And indeed, when he does finally enter the holy city, the authorities immediately look for an opportunity to kill him. They seek to have him arrested. They even try to entrap him in sedition and conspire to arrest Jesus by stealth and kill him. Chapter 11, verses 18, as well as chapter 12, verse 12, and chapter 14, 1. Soon after Jesus arrived in Jerusalem, he created a confrontation between himself and the temple authorities by driving the merchants from out of the temple court. And he, Jesus, entered the temple and began to drive out those who were selling and those who were buying in the temple. And he overturned the tables of money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he would not allow anyone to carry any vessels through the temple. He was teaching and saying, "My house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations, but you have made it a den of robbers," or in some transcripts, a den of thieves, or even a targum that says Canaanites. And when the chief priests and the scribes heard it, they kept looking for a way to kill him. For they were afraid of him, because the whole crowd was spellbound by his words and his teachings. Mark chapter 11, verses 15 through 18. Now, a couple of things I'd like to point out here. Because for this author, the preceding scene in Mark 11, he has his Jesus curse a fig tree because it wasn't producing any fruit, even though it was not fig season. So he cursed the tree to never be able to produce fruit ever again, and it withers away. Now this scene here, it's heavily connected to the temple in a way that he was saying that because of the corrupted temple cult, and of course the revolutionaries that took up refuge there to create a military fortress in the year 66, and the denial of Gentile offerings, which in fact was the catalyst that ignited the war with the Romans, he is saying that the fig tree in this story, just like the temple, have been cursed and can no longer produce anything fruitful. Now this author, he pulled this entire scene out of Josephus' Jewish Wars. And the line, "the den of robbers," is clearly referring to Eleazar ben Ananias, the temple captain that refused Gentile offerings because he wanted to piss off the emperor, and Simon Bar Gioras, who led the revolutionaries to take up arms in the temple court. This scene is putting the blame on those who chose to fight against the Romans, the Jewish revolutionaries, the Zealots, for the destruction of the temple. After the fact, of course. Now, some critics have argued that out of all the stories about Jesus in the gospel accounts, this bizarre demonstration of rage in the temple is most likely historically authentic. because it would provide a plausible motivation for Jesus getting himself executed. One can easily imagine Jesus in the tradition of the prophets, railing against commercial abuses of the temple cult and performing some symbolic action. Additionally, some have claimed that the followers of Jesus would have been loathed to concoct this potentially embarrassing and ridiculous depiction of Jesus. That's crazy stuff. But one needs to look no further than traditional memories of an actual historical event to explain this Markan episode. And that might be so. However, besides what we just talked about with respect to the symbolism of the Sicarii, creating a military refuge in the temple, we can also look at the cleansing of the temple in comparison to Odysseus' The Slaying of the Suitors. In Book 22, the king of Ithaca revealed his true identity and then commenced with his revenge. But Odysseus aimed and shot Antinous square in the throat, and the point went stabbing clean through the soft neck, and out and off to the side he pitched. The cup dropped from his grasp as the shaft sank home, and the man's life's blood came spurting out of his nostrils. Thick red jets, a sudden thrust of his foot. He kicked away the table. Food showered across the floor. The bread and meats soaked in a swirl of filthy blood. The suitors burst into an uproar all throughout the house when they saw their leader down. All leaped from their seats, milling about, desperate, scanning the stone walls. Not a shield in sight, no rugged spear to seize. Now, the overturning of tables and chairs and vessels recurs throughout Odysseus' orgy of violence. For example, one of the suitors, writhing over the table, curled and fell and spilled upon the floor the food and the two-handled cup. Now, the artistic representations of the scene do bear a striking resemblance to Mark's cleansing of the temple story. Because in this scene, this author went heavy on the allusions to the zealots and chose to go a little lighter on the allusions to Odysseus. But Mark usually does this. He has two-sided meanings in most of his stories to criticize either the Romans or the Jewish elite or the revolutionaries. And in many cases, as we'll examine, all three together at the same time. Here are the common themes: the presence of a small round table, along with various accessories such as drinking vessels, or a clay jar with handles, or a ceramic urn, crowns, containers for game tokens, and even cushions. But all these items, they are seemingly in disarray. The small round tables become the shields in Homer's Odyssey in 22.74. The round tables are overturned along with the dishes that they had supported. Now, Mark's allusion to Homer's hero from the Odyssey more than likely is not attacking Roman imperialism here, rather critiquing the Greek values so heavily that influenced the temple and its cult to the point of its own imminent doom. Mark's readers who had read the Odyssey would have picked up on the clever allusion to the moment that Jesus chose to start flipping tables over, which seemingly is quite out of character for this hero. Now, there are several key aspects of the slaying of the suitors that also seem to appear and correlate with Jesus' crazed behavior when he's inside the temple. Now, just like Odysseus, when he enters his house after leaving Emmaus' hut, Jesus enters the temple, which literally is his house from Bethany. When Odysseus slew the suitors, well, chairs, tables, and vessels, and food all went flying everywhere. Just like our hero Jesus in Mark's little tale. Jesus flipped over tables of the money exchangers, as well as the chairs of those who were selling doves, setting their contents to the ground. And then Jesus stopped anyone that tried to carry vessels through the temple. Now, this author for Mark, he went out of his way in order to justify his hero's actions in this scene. Just as Homer had justified Odysseus's actions, because his enemies had devastated his home. Just like in Mark's reality, right? The Zealots devastated the temple when they turned it into an armory or a fortress, if you would. And then Mark places some scriptural quotations on his Jesus' lips from the Greek Septuagint, Isaiah 56:7, which identifies the temple as Jesus' house, and then employs in light of that passage another one from Jeremiah 7:11, in which he mentions a den of thieves, or a house of robbers, or as I said in the Targum, a den of Canaanites. Just like Odysseus' house was overrun by the suitors. Now, in both stories, both heroes denounced those who had ruined their homes. The temple, of course, for Jesus, and the estate for Odysseus. And in both cases, the robbers, the den of thieves, or the suitors, they're afraid. The suitors because Odysseus threatened to kill them. And the Jewish leaders because of Jesus' overwhelming popularity and approval of the masses. The suitors promptly armed themselves in order to kill Odysseus and Telemachus, where the Jewish authorities kept looking for ways to kill Jesus. Now, following this cleansing of the temple scene, Mark has this Jesus get into this debate with the Jewish leaders concerning his authority to kick the merchants and vendors out from the temple. But what he does next is he cleverly concealed and embedded inside this fictitious dispute a parable about the wicked tenants. The wicked tenants. Which is where this author depicts the Jewish authorities as treacherous wine dressers to whom a landowner had given responsibilities for his vineyard while he was off in another country. The house sitters abused the homeowner's servants and even succeeded in killing his beloved son. And in this parable of Mark's, the master will return to slay the wine dressers and then give the vineyard away to others. The Jewish authorities in Mark's story, being the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders, they recognized Jesus' little story as an allegory depicting them as the wine dressers who corrupted the temple and Judaism. And of course, Jesus as the beloved son, who they wanted to kill and soon would, implying that his father, God, would destroy them all. This is a clear connection that this author makes to the destruction of the temple being the fault of both the Jewish elite, siding with Roman imperialism, and the Jewish revolutionaries. Now, just like the vineyard owner in Mark's parable about the wicked tenants. Because Odysseus, too, he was a builder who went on a journey and left his estate in the hands of his servants, some of who joined the suitors in eating their rightful lord out of house and home. However, the servants who remained faithful to Odysseus, to their lord, continuously suffered abuse and humiliation. And instead of respecting the lord's son, that is, Telemachus, the suitors plotted to kill him, suspecting that the owner had drowned at sea and would never return. And they had no regard for Telemachus' rightful authority over his father's estate, and each had hoped that he would become the new owner of the estate by marrying Penelope. When Odysseus returned, he, like the owner of the vineyard in Jesus' little story, destroyed the suitors for their violent insolence. So I believe that this comparison of the parable with Homer's epic, it also suggests an answer to a problem within the parable itself that has often stumped scholars for years. Because the tenants assumed that if they kill off the heir, well, they would inherit the vineyard. But no society would ever award property to an heir's murderer. And the same problem also appears in Homer's epic, where one of the suitors proposed that they kill Telemachus and then distribute his possessions amongst themselves. Never mind Penelope. In quotation, "Let us here devise for him a woeful death for Telemachus, and let him not escape out of our hands. Let us seize him in the field far from the city on the road, and his property. Let us ourselves keep, and his treasures, dividing them fairly among us all. The Odyssey, chapter 16, pages 371 to 372, and 383 to 385. How the suitors collectively could have any lawful claim on his estate is really hard to imagine. This simply illustrates the suitors' general tendency to treat Telemachus' property as if it were their own. The same irrational greed applies to the wicked wine dressers in Mark's Jesus parable. In quotation, those tenants said to one another, "This is the heir. Come, let us kill him, and the inheritance will be ours." So they seized him, killed him, and threw him out of the vineyard. When we compare the Odyssey with Mark's parable about the wicked tenant, we get this. So here's, I'm going to read the Odyssey, then I'll read the wicked tenants, and we'll do like a little side-by-side. So here's the side-by-side comparison. From the Odyssey, we get this. Odysseus built his house, put his servants in charge, and went off to fight in Troy. The suitors abused the master's servants and ate from the estate as though it were their own. The wicked tenant goes like this. A man planted a vineyard, put a fence around it, and built a watchtower. Then he leased it to his tenants and went to another country. The tenants abused the master's servants and kept the produce of the vineyard for themselves. Then the Odyssey, Telemachus, the beloved son, sought to regain his authority over the estate. Then among them spoke, "Let us devise for him a woeful death for Telemachus. His property, let us ourselves keep his treasures, divide them fairly amongst us all." And then in the wicked tenant, the master sent his beloved son, the heir, to collect the produce from the vineyard. But those tenants said to one another, "This is the heir. Let us kill him, and the inheritance will be ours." Then the Odyssey, the suitors laid an ambush for the beloved son, but he eluded them. Odysseus returned and destroyed the suitors and reestablished his authority. The suitors had to be cautious for fear the residents of Ithaca might drive them from the island. And then the wicked tenant ends, so they seized him, killed him, and threw him out of the vineyard. What will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and destroy the tenants and give the vineyard to the others. The authorities recognized that Jesus spoke this parable against them, and they wanted to arrest him, but they feared the crowd. Now, the infamous and the mysterious and missing cue that most scholars believe is the missing link between Mark's narrative and the added piece in Matthew and Luke contained a condemnation of the Pharisees for their taking delight in social privileges. So Mark obviously was aware of the saying too, perhaps directly from this missing gospel, but also added several telling elements that seem to be reminiscent of Homer's sutures. Now in Q, otherwise Matthew from a source perspective, in 23 verses 6 to 7 says, "Woe to you, Pharisees, for you love to have the seat of honor in synagogues and to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces." Now compare this to Mark in 12:39-40, where he says, "Beware of the scribes, who like to walk around in long robes, and to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces, and to have the best seats in the synagogues and places of honor at banquets. They devour widows' houses, and for the sake of appearance, say long, lengthy prayers. They will receive the greatest of condemnation." Now, in Mark's version of the saying, it adds, among other things, loving places of honor at banquets. Then the other, even stranger one, the devouring of widows' houses. Now, our guy Mark here, he never does explain what he meant by these later phrases, and ultimately, several New Testament scholars have proposed a variety of historical explanations. But the solution probably has less to do with the scribes of history than with their rhetoric of criticism. Because to accuse a group of defrauding widows is to depict them as low-life scum, who are deserving of greater condemnation. Now, in light of Homer's Odyssey, Mark's additions to the saying once again like the Jewish authorities, directly with Penelope's suitors, who fought with each other for honor at banquets, they devoured the house of Penelope, whom they considered to be a widow while Odysseus was out fighting the Trojan War, and therefore deserved their death at the hands of Odysseus. Even the Greek that Mark uses, "they devour the houses of the widows," finds several key parallels among Homer's depiction of the suitors. The poet often speaks of their devouring Odysseus's house because of their devastation of the home of a presumed widow. The suitors became the personification of pride and greed. Now check this out, because immediately after Jesus' denunciation of the Jewish authorities, Mark then goes and contrasts them with a poor widow, whom the reader would reasonably consider an example of the widow whom the scribes had exploited. Although this widow contributed but a few cents to the temple donation box, she sacrificed her entire livelihood, which therefore made her small offering way more valuable and meaningful than the hefty donations from the wealthy and elite. Mark's depiction of the Jewish authorities and the poor widow actually correspond to Homer's contrast between the suitors, who devoured Odysseus's house, and Penelope, who is presumed a widow, as well as a symbol of hospitality. Because she gave so generously from her rapidly dwindling estate, while the suitors were stingy, even when distributing what they had stolen from her. Only Mark and Luke, oddly enough, contrast the Jewish authorities with the poor widow. And Luke offers it, you know, in a support from using Mark as a source, just like Mark was dependent on Homer for a source. And Matthew, well, he evidently missed what Mark was doing entirely, or simply didn't like what he was doing. Whereas Luke hangs on to a few of his transvaluations. And then John, well, he's like Las Vegas, man. He's just riding on his own, in a whole different time altogether. And in addition to this widow, two other minor characters derive their identities regarding the Jewish authorities. Let's look at Judas, for example. Because so far, like Homer's Melanthius, betrayed his master to his enemies. And Barabbas. Barabbas too, because like Iris, he is a rogue whom the murderous rivals preferred to the rightful owner of the house. The murderous rivals being the Jewish authorities, choosing Barabbas over Jesus, which also has some major theological ties to the Passover ritual, as we've talked about, and the two identical goats being sacrificed for the sins of all of Israel. One was a blood atonement sacrifice, while the other played the role of the scapegoat that would be released into the wild. Now, Mark employs the symbolism of Jesus being the blood atonement sacrifice, while having the Jewish authorities choose Barabbas to set free, whose name is also Jesus Barabbas. And in Aramaic, Barabbas simply means son of the Father. So here you have it. Two sons of the Father, or two identical goats. This author successfully merged two iconic epics into each other to represent the same idea, one Greek while the other in Jewish. Now, when we talk about Odysseus' servant, Melanthius, he was convinced that his master Odysseus had died at sea during the Trojan War. And then he switched allegiances to the suitors and then provided them with the livestock that they needed in order to fulfill their enormous appetites. And in return, the suitors treated him as a peer at their feasts. As in the following passage says, "At once he entered Odysseus's palace and sat down among the suitors opposite Eurymachus, for he loved him best of all. Then by him those that served set a portion of meat, and the revered housekeeper brought and set before him bread for him to eat." Melanthius here, he came not to serve, but Melanthius came to be served. Now, when we look at the role of Melanthius in the epic, it most certainly seems to resemble Mark's Judas, who also switches his loyalty for greed. The authorities promised to give him money, some shekels, right, if he would betray Jesus and turn him over to them. Just like Melanthius, Judas took his place at the meal, to which he had no right to be there as a traitor. Then in Mark we get this. Jesus speaking says, "Truly I tell you, one of you will betray me, one who is eating with me. It is one of the 12 who is dipping his bread into the bowl with me. For the Son of Man goes, as it is written of him. But woe to that one by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for that one to not have been born at all." Mark chapter 14, 18 through 21. And at one point in Homer's epic, Melanthius came dangerously close to recognizing his master and revealing him to the suitors for who he really is. Just like Judas, who had to reveal Jesus to the Jewish authorities. The epic reads like this. "Hear me now, suitors of the glorious queen, regarding this stranger, for in truth I have seen him before. Truly, it was the swineherd that led him here. But of the man himself I do not know surely from where he claims he was born." End quote. Now, ironically, Melanthius did not know the birthplace of the stranger, even though he was dining at the very spot. Now, Melanthius' primary role in the slaying of the suitors was to supply them with arms. This is important. In quotation, "Melanthius, the goatherd, mounted up by the steps of the hall of the storeroom doors of Odysseus. Thence he took 12 shields, as many spears, and many helmets of bronze with thick plumes of horsehair, and went his way, and quickly brought and gave them to the suitors." End quote. Now, just like Judas, he was associated with the weapons because at Jesus' arrest, he arrives with the crowd with swords and clubs from the chief priest, the scribes, and the elders. Mark 14:43. So after Odysseus and Telemachus had slain the suitors, Homer writes this line. "Out they led Melanthius through the doorway and the court, and they cut off his nostrils and ears with pitiless bronze, and tore out his genitals for the dogs to eat raw, and cut off his hands and his feet in the anger of their hearts." Now, unfortunately, our author here for Mark, well, this storyteller, he doesn't narrate a punishment for Judas, even though he has his Jesus tell him that it would have been better for him to have never been born at all. And then Matthew, well, he doesn't like that ending, so he actually has Judas go hang himself. But Luke and John see that he was possessed by the devil, and his body spilled out into a field that he had either purchased or the chief priest had purchased for burying a place to bury some strangers. But where Mark had failed to improvise, his later redactors filled in 3 different accounts of the punitive death of Judas. Mark's possible appreciation to Homer's Melanthius, it may also explain the awkward motivation for the bribe from the chief priest. Because Jesus had entered the temple amid the accolades of the crowd, he had chased away the money changers and the merchants from the temple court, inviting the murderous wrath of the chief priests and scribes. Then here he challenges the authority of the chief priest, as well as the scribes and the elders, and he told them that they would all perish for their violence. He also disputed with them for several days on end. And despite this public awareness, this public accessibility, the chief priest still need to pay Judas to be able to find out where Jesus is hiding and who he is and what he looks like. Apparently, because even though they had met and seen Jesus over and over and over again and disputed with him and argued with him and seen him in the temple court, they just could not seem to recognize Jesus without the help of Judas. Our author for Mark seems clumsily to have retained this motif of recognition from Homer. None of the suitors had ever met Odysseus, so obviously they wouldn't be able to recognize him on their own without the help of Melanthius. At the beginning of Odyssey, chapter 18, there's a character who is introduced that is a beggar, and his name is Arnaeus, which literally means lamb. And he's nicknamed Iris, because like Iris, the messenger goddess, he used to run errands when anyone bade him. Iris in the story was known for his greedy belly, eating and drinking to without any end. When he arrived at the palace, well, he discovered that there was another beggar, who was actually Odysseus in disguise. And he was taking over his territory. So he told him to give way or risk a drubbing. And of course, the suitors egged him on by saying, "Do you not see that everyone is winking at me," said Iris, "and urging me to drag you?" Although Odysseus could have destroyed the rogue with one single blow, he instead decides to pull his punch and merely disable him, for fear that he might create suspicions concerning his true identity as Odysseus. Now this scene here is skillfully, as well as ironically, it places Odysseus, who is the rightful owner of the estate, or of his house, in the role of a beggar who must contend with the violent, greedy, and oversized good-for-nothing. His rival here, though a tramp, was nicknamed by Homer after a goddess, Iris, or Iris, which literally means rainbow, right? The symbol that God gave to his people that he would no longer kill anyone. And to Mark, this would be very significant in his story. The anti-hero, Barabbas, who is the son of the Father and also named Jesus. Jesus Barabbas, Jesus the son of the Father, who is a scoundrel and a criminal. Just like our new character here, Arnaeus, who is also a scoundrel but is a lamb like Jesus, who represents more evil and more death. But the most unmistakable irony comes at the end of the fight, when now all of a sudden the suitors are praising Odysseus as the victorious beggar. "May Zeus grant you, stranger, and the other gods, what you desire most and the dearest wish of your heart." Now, what Odysseus wanted most was, of course, was to slay the very people who were praising him. And again, one of the suitors raised his cup to toast the victor. "Hail, farther stranger, may happy fortune be yours in time to come, though now you are beset by many sorrows." Odysseus will have happy fortune only when those who are toasting him are all dead. Now, Mark's answer to Iris is his invention in the introduction of the character Barabbas. Because after the Jewish authorities had formally condemned Jesus in Mark's tale, they immediately handed him over to Pilate, who, according to Josephus, was this ruthless Roman governor in charge of Judea from 27 to 37 of the Common Era. And Mark writes this, "Now at the festival, he, Pilate, used to release a prisoner for them, anyone whom they asked." Mark 15:6. Now, based on everything that we were told about this guy, Pontius Pilate, this is the very last thing that he would ever consider doing for the Jews. In fact, it really looks like he hated them tremendously and would never honor such a tradition if one actually existed. One of releasing prisoners, that is. Not to mention, there is zero evidence from any source outside the Gospels that this was something that was ever remotely practiced. Mark seems to have handcrafted this event in order to provide a contest between the Lord and the bandit, just as Homer did with Odysseus and Iris. Now let's compare the two. In the Odyssey 18, 1 through 3, as well as 6, I quote, "Now there came up a public beggar who was accustomed to beg through the town, and was known for having a greedy belly, eating and drinking without end. Iris, all the young men called him." Now, in Mark 15, verse 7, we get this. Now there was a prisoner named Barabbas in prison with the rebels who had committed murder during their insurrection. Now in Mark's mind, he's developing this character from the recent wars of his time. The war of 66 to 70 between the Jewish insurrectionists and the Roman occupiers. But he paints both Iris and Barabbas as violent rogues. And both have significant literary names. Iris from the goddess Iris, and Barabbas for Jesus, the Son of the Father, giving his readers two Jesuses that were both sons of the Father to fulfill the Leviticus narrative of the scapegoat and the blood atonement sacrifice. Now, Mark probably expected, or at least hoped at a minimum, that its readers would see the irony of a contest between two sons of Abba. One, a revolutionary who brought death to millions of Jews, the destruction of their city, as well as their holy temple. While the other is the true king of the Jews. Barabbas, more than likely, represented the rebel leader, John Gascala, and his cohort, Simon Bar-Gioras, who led the Jews into a war with the Romans in 66. Now, the comparison between Barabbas and Jesus is even more striking in the Gospel of Matthew. Because in Mark, he only refers to the criminal as Barabbas, which basically just son of the Father. Whereas the author for Matthew understood what Mark was doing and added the name Jesus to Barabbas, Jesus Barabbas, to make the connection all the more clear to the reader. Matthew really wanted to make sure that his audience understood the connection to Leviticus and the two identical sheep narrative, the blood atonement sacrifice, the Passover, Yom Kippur. In Homer's tale, just as the suitors had instigated the fight and sided with Iris, the Jewish crowd in Mark's story asked Pilate to release a prisoner to them. And then the crowd was stirred up by the chief priests. And then they ultimately sided with Barabbas instead of their true king, Jesus. Jesus they wanted to crucify. Just as Homer had used Iris in order to incriminate the suitors, Mark used Barabbas in order to incriminate the Jewish authorities. In Mark 2, there are ironies. A Roman judge called Jesus King of the Jews. But the crowd and the chief priests, the scribes and the elders, basically all the Jews, preferred a murderer over their rightful king. So in Mark's narrative, by killing Jesus, the Jewish authorities and the Jews secured their own destruction. They chose death. Like the murderous tenant's parable, whom the Lord of the vineyard, the father of the victim, will slay. The epic and the gospel both accomplished their ironies by keeping the identities of the heroes a secret from the other characters, who favor a criminal instead. Now, in Mark's mind, by making these several connections to Homer and to Jewish scripture, he was sure that all of his readers would understand what his true message was. The revolutionaries that had caused so much bloodshed were who the Jews chose over their true king, the King of Peace, whether real or not. Instead, they followed false prophets, teaching another gospel altogether, who were claiming to be responding to God's wishes by bringing wrath and death to the Romans. Mark ends Jesus' trial before Pilate with yet another irony, one that seems to parallel the toast at the end of the Iris incident. When reviewing side by side, in the Odyssey 18, pages 118 to 122, Homer writes this, "And Antinous set before him a great paunch, filled with fat and blood, and Amphinomus took up two loaves from the basket and set them before him, and pledged him in a cup of gold, and said, "Hail, Father Stranger, may happy fortune be yours in time to come." Now in Mark's narrative, in 15:17-19, we get this. "And they, the soldiers, clothed him in a purple cloak, and after twisting some thorns to a crown, they put it on his head. And they began saluting him, 'Hail, King of the Jews!' They struck his head with a reed, spat upon him, and knelt down in homage to him." Odysseus, too, also wore a purple cloak in Homer's tale. As in antiquity, purple was synonymous with royalty and kings. But in both Homer and in Mark, the garment is dyed with the color of irony. Odysseus and Penelope remember the hero in a magnificent purple robe. But now he appears in disguise as a miserable beggar. Where Jesus, on the other hand, on his death march to his cross, is mockingly dressed in a purple robe by the very people who executed him. Now, it might be interesting to add that this is the only instance where the Greek word for hail occurs in any address by Mark. And it's used here in a very similar context to Homer's use of the word. It's hardly accidental or coincidental. Now, Homer and Mark therefore used Iris and Barabbas in order to intensify the guilt of their hero's opponents. And for Mark, it also worked out well for his connection to Jewish scripture. This is the genius behind Mark, to fulfill the same narrative and message, but to two separate audiences, pagan Greeks and Jews. Instead of siding with the righteous, the path of peace and not war, for Mark, the opponent instead favored a boorish beggar or a revolutionary. Ironically, the suitors toasted Odysseus, "Hail, Father Stranger," wishing him happy fortune, unaware that soon he would have his good fortune at their expense. Ironically, in Mark, the soldiers saluted Jesus, "Hail, King of the Jews," unaware that he, in fact, was a king, and that he would indeed reign. Now, given the popularity of the epic in antiquity, one could hardly cast doubt that Homer's portrayal of Odysseus as the suffering hero, or his crew of foolish, unbelieving, and doubting weaklings, and not to mention the suitors as murderous rivals, were accessible to Mark. Not to mention that anyone who learned how to read and write in antiquity, they learned from Homer's epics. The Odyssey was the study guide. The evangelist who penned Mark was also very much aware of the Dioscuri as the sons of Zeus, the thunder god, who are often depicted on the right and left side of a seated deity, and typically Zeus. Also, Mark's borrowings have similarities in ancient comparisons of Odysseus with the suffering of others, and a comparison of the slaying of the suitors with other massacres. For example, this scene also inspired the destruction of the lecherous rogues in the story of Apollonius, the king of Tyre. Josephus probably had the slaying of the suitors on his mind when he was describing David's annihilation of the Amalekites.
"Falling suddenly upon them, he made a great slaughter of them. For being unarmed and expecting no such thing, but intent upon drinking and revelry, they were all an easy prey. Some being surprised with the outspread tables, were massacres beside them, and their streaming blood swept victual and food away. Others were drinking each other's health when he slew them. Still others, under the influence of strong drink, were plunged in sleep. While those who had been quick enough to put their armor on and make a stand against him, these two he cut into pieces with no less ease than those who lay defenseless on the ground."
the very volume of these similarities absolutely suggests, demonstrates, and perhaps proves that the gospel accounts are all imitations. Because Jesus, just like Odysseus, too was a carpenter who had to suffer many things. Returned to his fatherland without honor. Flipped over tables, chairs, and vessels in an outrage because his home had become a den of thieves. Betrayed by one of his own closest associates. And was despised by his opponents in favor of a rogue criminal. And one day would return violently against them. And Jesus' disciples often resemble Odysseus' crew in their folly and their weakness. The Boanerges echo themes of the Dioscuri. The Jewish authorities, who devoured the house of the widows and sought to kill the beloved son, play the part of the suitors. The widow, Judas, and Barabbas all function the same literary way as Penelope, Melanthius, and now Iris. The similarities in all of these characterizations are all seriously dense and thick. Now, many of these similarities, though not all of them, also follow in the same order or pattern of events. Because early on in both books, the reader first learns of the murderous intentions of the rivals, being the suitors or the Jewish authorities, whose hubris and culpability seemingly steadily escalates. Odysseus' crew and Jesus' disciples, they first appear positively, but for whatever reason, will consistently fail both heroes. Until the end, both heroes must face their enemies alone. And like Penelope, Melanthius, and Iris, the generous widow, Judas, and Barabbas, they only come into the story after the hero has returned home. The most noteworthy difference in order is the clever reversal of the arguments over authority and the cleansing of the house. Because Homer used the slaying of the suitors to conclude the controversy over authority, where the author from Mark used the cleansing of the temple to initiate that controversy with the Jewish authorities. There are also several details in the comparisons that are so distinctive, such as the description of Jesus as a carpenter and the disciples as sailors, so many shipwreck scenes. The request of James and John, the sons of thunder, to enjoy eternal glory, similar to that of Castor and Polydeuces, or Pollux if you prefer, the sons of the thunder god, Zeus. The claim that the Jewish authorities sought the best seats at banquets and devoured the house of the widows. The identification of the temple as Jesus' house, which had become a den of thieves. The contrast between the protagonist and the rogue championed by the rivals. Mark's depiction of the cleansing of the temple contains unusual details that also appear in the slaying of the suitors. The fallen tables, chairs, and vessels. This earliest evangelist, who we refer to as Mark, may have purposely supplied these flags in order to prompt or direct his readers to his literary models. Furthermore, these comparisons are interpretable because they explain several aspects of Mark that have stumped the redactors like the authors who wrote Matthew and Luke, who didn't catch on to what Mark was trying to do with this literary myth. They removed the parts that they didn't like or agree with and then embellished them on their own, such as the entire nativity story. The parallels with the Odyssey may also account for the reason why Jesus had to be a carpenter. And the joint naming and peculiar requests of the sons of Zebedee. Or the foolishness and weakness and the failure of the disciples. And the outrageous caricature of the Jewish authorities as corruptible murderers. This author, who penned the book of Mark, not only imitated Homer's models, but he has emulated them as well. Jesus simply had to suffer way more than Odysseus, insofar as he was killed. Zeus granted the Dioscuri their request for special treatment after death, while Jesus, of course, refused a request at the Boanerges. Brothers James and John, of course. They would have to earn this honor through suffering. Odysseus purged his house of usurpers by mercilessly slaying them. Jesus, too, purged his house, the temple of usurpers, by merely expelling them, making them leave. I think that this playfulness between the literary imitations and the transvaluative immolations run all through Mark's Homeric epic and his documentary on the war of 66 to 70 CE. This, my friends, has been a Skeptical Ghost Heathen production.